Hello and welcome to Cinemakers, Amy Heckerling. This is episode 49, Look Who's Talking, from 1989. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Kara Gellerigan.
And I want to apologize to this movie. Last week, I think, when I was talking about how devastated I was that we were doing these movies, that Johnny Dangerously was not my speed at all, and then European Vacation was even less so my speed, I was like, and we got that stupid Talking Baby movie next week. I was so wrong. I love this movie. This movie is incredible. It's weird and wonderful. All you need to know, I think, about the making of this movie, I'm going to drop a trivia thing up front. In Kirstie Alley's memoir, she admitted that she fell in love with John Travolta while making this movie, but decided to remain true to her husband, her partner, and did not act on it. But that is, I think, indicative of the level of love found on this set.
And later, she referred to him as the love of her life.
Wow. Whoa. Yeah. I love that. That story is the love of my life.
Joey, I mean, I don't want to ever say I told you so, but like, I kind of, you know, I was saying this is going to be a good movie, like to hang in there, not to get too discouraged, that there were things coming that were going to make you happy. So I'm really glad that you enjoyed this.
Oh,
that makes
gosh.
Me very, very happy.
I love it.
As I've stated previously multiple times on this very podcast, Clueless is my favorite movie, but in the past year or so, I've been like, wow, I'm in my 30s now. I should maybe get a new favorite movie that doesn't involve high school students. And you guys, what if this is my new favorite movie?
Ooh. Cool.
I don't know. I don't know for sure, but I did watch it twice in 2 days, and it's amazing.
When you said I'm in my 30s, I was like, oh, this sentence is going to go in a very different way. Because we just had your podcasting partner, Jordan Pullen Clark, and by just, I mean, as we're recording this, came out probably about a month or so ago, maybe a little bit more, actually a little bit more than a month ago on our Watch the Throne feed.
So not just at all.
Not at all, because we are recording early, and then this is late, and it's all a thing. But Jordan was on Watch the Throne with me and Mike to talk about Tully, and she was talking about how in that movie, it's very clearly, it seems to her, that Marlo, the Charlize Theron character, had children because her biological clock was ticking, and she had to make a decision. And so that's a phrase that's uttered in here. So when you were saying, you know, I'm in my 30s now, and I was like, oh, and that just, it went in a completely different direction.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't want kids. There is no clock.
It was as much of an about face in my head as going from European Vacation was to this. I mean, it is leaps and bounds. And also, you know, we've talked about it the last couple times. This is the first movie that we've done that she wrote. And it's clear that this movie matters to her, that the story matters. You know, her dad is in this. Her husband is in this. It's a very personal project.
Even her daughter.
You know, it's wonderful.
It feels like she shines through in this movie mm-hmm. as well. Like, I feel like I know her better mm-hmm. after watching this.
For
you know,
sure.
It's extremely personal, but also incredibly accessible.
Like we talked about in the first episode, I think, that a lot of times women, not just in film, but since we're talking about a film, women in film and women directors especially wind up having their careers kind of cut short or altered or whatever, projects fall apart because they get pregnant and have a kid. And not necessarily like because of that, more because of like how everyone around them reacts to that. But I think it's so rad that like this was inspired by her having a kid, and it's her biggest hit, and it was this huge, huge movie that feels so Amy Heckerling. I love it. There were things that I didn't love about it the first time that I watched it, and then the second time I watched it, I was like, I don't care about any of them.
Like, it's kind of crazy, like, the mass appeal I feel like this movie has. Like, this came out in 89, and I was brought to the theater with my parents and family to go see this movie. I mean, I had no idea what was happening in that opening sequence at the time. But, you know, throughout the years, like, this became a very quoted film in my house. Stuff like, not lamb, lame, and other lines in this movie just, like, became part of our family. Like, it was really funny just how watched this movie has been over the years for me.
Let us talk about that opening sequence, because
oh my God.
You both watched it before I did, and you were talking in our little thread about how it is maybe the craziest opening scene in movie history. And my response was, you can listen to and you can go watch Superman 3 and hear Mike and me talk about it on Mike's Third Time the Charm episode about it. That movie has the best opening sequence. This one, as soon as I saw this thing that like I had a sense of what it was, I was like, is this a Fight Club style journey through a fallopian tube? And the answer is yes.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah it is.
And I was like, oh my God, like this is how the movie starts and ends. And there is animation, then real life action, and then more animation with crazy voices. And it is weird and wonderful. And these 30-second little animation things brought me more joy than anything in the last two movies we did at all. Like, it's just from the jump, I was like, oh, I'm in good hands here. This is the kind of movie that I want to watch.
It made me laugh so hard I triggered my own menstrual cramps. Blew my mind. And actually, it's not just animation. It was like a combination of both practical effects and visual effects. Although Amy Heckerling made sure to point out in an interview that she did that back then they called them electronic effects.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But what they did was they had to, like, because eventually you see, like, the zygote develop into a fetus, into a baby.
Voiced by Bruce Willis.
We'll get to that. So they actually had to make like 5 different models, and they were actually like little puppets. So like some of the shots were super complicated. And then the part where the egg and the sperm are like traveling through the fallopian tube, the sperm were little vinyl sperm. I don't know. They made them out of vinyl.
Like puppets.
Yeah. And put fishing weights in the front of them. And so they were dumped in a tank and then cascaded down the tank through water and picked up by an underwater camera. Because I was watching it and I was like, how did they do this? It's 1989. And I was trying to figure out, like, was it animation or like whatever, but like the lighting seemed weird. And so that was like one of the first things I looked up after I watched it, because it was very exciting to me.
That's amazing.
Is it a little crazy that you got away with this? I mean,
you see it in like fourth grade, right? Like you see this kind of thing, right?
I guess you're right. If it didn't have the Bruce Willis and the Beach Boys playing, it looks like an instructional video.
Yeah.
Probably look like maybe put it in sepia tone or something like that, and yeah, you're right there. It's the addition of like all of them saying like, come on guys, like I got the map, like over here, I see something up ahead, and then like I Get Around by the Beach Boys. I mean, just all the whole combination is just hilarious.
Yeah, I don't know that this scene is overly sexual, but I'm sure Kara read this. There was trivia that Amy Heckerling first pitched this to Disney, mm-hmm. and Disney CEO Michael Eisner said that it was too sexual even for their racier Touchstone Pictures banner. And then a whole bunch of other studios passed on it. Eventually, TriStar liked the script enough and greenlit the film with a $7 million budget. But, like, this movie, whether it was the scene or later when Travolta and Kirstie Alley are having sex or whatever, there's just enough sexual innuendo or, like, because it's, you don't, there's no nudity. You know, there's no overt, like, there's just, like, they just kiss. Like, there's nothing even, like, really super suggestive, but it was enough to scare production studios away from funding this. And I hope that's not, but it also might be part of what Kara was saying earlier about the world seeing Amy Heckerling like, oh, you have a kid, like you can't make a movie. Like, you know, it might be part of that, but.
And also, like, people don't go to see movies starring women, and no one cares about pregnancy. And, like, you know, there's a whole thing. Yeah.
Oh, we're going to play a little bit of quick Joey trivia. One of my favorite childhood movies starred Kirstie Alley. Can either of you guess it?
I don't know, but I have a favorite movie when I was a teenager that starred Kirstie Alley. I wonder if it's the same film.
Probably, almost certainly not.
They reference it in this movie, actually.
Before you do the trivia, though, I just want to point out that a piece of feedback that she had gotten from the studio when we were talking about Fast Times at Ridgemont High was that the movie was too sexual but not sexy. And I think that's something that is going to kind of come up again and again and again. And in this movie, that is very much the case, because it is sexual. It's literally like it's actual. This is what happens when people have sex, right? But it's not sexy. And the way that even the almost sex scene is shot, and we can get into that later, but again, these are sexual things that are happening, but not necessarily in a very sexy way.
Yeah, there's very adult themes. Like, every theme in here, I feel, is like a very adult, whether it be the relationship between Travolta and the boy, and Travolta mm-hmm. And Kirstie Alley and her, you know, the man that she got pregnant with. Like, all those things, I think, combine together to make it a complex drama, but it's a comedy drama, so
it's also a rom-com. Like, it is,
that's it, that's what it is. Yeah, it feels more like a rom-com, right? Yeah.
Well, so Mike, for your trivia, I know that there are two different Kirstie Alley movies referenced in this, one of which was covered on Brian Rodriguez's podcast. Is that the one you're talking about?
No, not that I nope.
Oh, because she mentions that she might have to go to summer school.
Ah, very nice.
You know, once she drops out of Lamaze class. So summer school, check out High School Summer Party, which is a really, really fun movie. Was the other one Star Trek 2?
Yes, it was. Wrath of Khan.
There you go. My favorite Kirstie Alley movie came out, I think, like 7 years after this. And if this was a movie that you liked as a teenager, we were going to have sort of big problems.
I'm on edge here.
I loved It Takes Two with the Olsen twins and Kirstie Alley.
Oh,
ooh,
yeah.
Boy. Oh, man. Don't watch it now, but, like, it was great in 96 or whenever. Like, it was, you know, right my alley. It's sort of, I want to say Parent Trap-y. Like, I think it's pretty much Parent Trap, but with Kirstie Alley. And I want to say Steve Guttenberg, but that might not be right.
She was also in that, like, Amish movie, right? With Tim Allen, question mark? I don't know if that was who that was.
Yep. They were hiding from the mob or something.
Yeah. Richer or poorer.
I mean, I used to watch Full House, so I'm aware of the Olsen twins back then.
Did you know, speaking of Full House, that John Stamos was the first choice for the Travolta role?
No.
But then the producers of Full House would not let him out of his contract, and so they considered Michael Keaton, Mel Gibson, Jeff Goldblum, and Griffin Dunn, and then eventually went with Travolta. This was his first acting role, I think, in like 5 years.
Was this before or after The Experts? He had just done like The Experts at some point in the 90s.
This was the same year as The Experts. He was in with Kelly Preston in The Experts.
Yeah, I think that's where he met her, and they end up getting married, and they're nightclub owners that are secretly flown to Russia to train a bunch of sleeper cells that are going to be implanted in middle America. It's crazy. Check it out.
Travolta is so good in this movie, and I realized about 20 minutes in, I was like, oh shit, in 5 years, this baby is going to murder John Travolta on a toilet in Pulp Fiction. Which yeah. Blew my mind.
I'll tell you what, I remember vividly what blew my mind in theaters, but aside from the title sequence, was not realizing it was John Travolta until like 3 scenes later, where he comes to the house to return the purse, and I leaned over to my mom, I was like, that's Travolta? Because like, as a kid, I had just really known him from Grease and stuff, and like, he just did not look familiar to me. I was just really surprised, but I mean, he kills it in this. He's fantastic. He dances with a baby, he dances with Kirstie Alley, dances all over this joint.
I love the dance scenes. They were so good.
One thing I noticed about the dance scenes, I don't know if either of you caught this, and the only reason I noticed it is because of our conversation from Fast Times, but there's a couple close-ups of Mikey's Nikes, which rhyme, and I was wondering, you know, because Spicoli made Vans popular, right? Like, I wonder if Amy Heckerling was like, I did it once, let's see if I could do it again. Like, I wonder if toddler sales of Nike shoes boomed after this movie, because, like, he looks so cool in those little Velcro Nikes.
Yeah. Oh my God. And all of the actors, I think there were like 5 different kids. There were a bunch of babies that they had because they had to like get a baby
sure.
in the right mood for different scenes, you know? And then the kid that plays him as a toddler, they're all so good.
They are really, really good.
Yeah. You know, they say, especially as like, I mean, this isn't her first feature or anything, but they say like, you know, you really shouldn't work with children or pets or animals if you can avoid it. And it's like, this is all kids. Like, she's working with nothing really, but like all those little kids and stuff. And the performances and like the facial expressions, like she got exactly what she needed to, you know, do whatever she did in editing with the voiceover and stuff. Like, it's just incredible, like, the clarity it seems like she had going into this whole thing. It's like, it just feels like such a complete vision.
And what I love about the voiceover, I mean, the voiceover, like, Bruce Willis is great throughout, and the other actors that they have come in here and there, like, as all the little girls that he's, like, flirting with, I guess, throughout the entire movie. But at the end, when Mikey walks to the car to drive away and gets in, and he's like, it feels a little different, but also in a way that I love, where it feels like Bruce Willis is like commenting on the scene. He's like, well, I'm just going to put this toy right here because that's where that goes, and just like gets in the car. And it feels sort of like almost third person as opposed to first person, but it works in that scene, I think. Like, he's so good throughout just communicating this inner monologue of this toddler. And then there, when he's just walking to the car, it just feels weird and wonderful. In a slightly different way that I love even more.
Yeah. Apparently in other countries, Mikey's voice was taken on by popular regional stars, which was actually allegedly Travolta's idea when they released the movie in foreign markets. He had the idea of getting different celebrities in different countries to be cast as the baby, so you'd have a Spanish or an Italian star, and that made a big difference in the appeal.
That's really smart, actually. You know, I don't know if Bruce Willis was too pleased with that idea. What I thought was very interesting is how sometimes the baby talk is, it could be considered like cheating a little bit. Like, babies talk to each other, and it almost seems like, well, what are they, like reading each other's mind or something? Because they're clearly not speaking. But I was like totally fine with that. Like, I didn't care about that, you know what I mean? She created like such a great distinction between sort of like reality and baby reality, I guess. I don't know what really else to call it. And I think a great trick that helped that she brought back, that Kara, I know you were commenting on in a previous episode, are the dream sequences.
Hell yeah, they're so good in this.
And I just think that going into those different styles from time to time just helps to accept this broken reality of, you know, babies being able to talk and things and stuff. So, like, that's just really, really clever directing and, like, really tough stuff to manage. And, like, it just feels so, I'm not going to say, like, effortless or anything, because, like, it looks like this was hard work to do with the baby stuff and everything. But it's pretty flawless. Like, it's super clean. This movie's, like, really brisk. It's fast. It's funny.
It's just, what a tremendous amount of vision this sort of thing, I think, would require. Yeah, the dream sequences and like fantasy sequences and premonition, the nightmare, like there's like kind of a full spectrum of those things in this that are so wonderful. And something that I was kind of like clicking through a bunch of her movies and a bunch of the crew on different movies, like trying to figure out who she works with, like from movie to movie, to see if there's anyone that she like kind of takes with her, because she does, it's hard to like pinpoint, but she really does have this very cohesive kind of style and voice. And it turns out that she's used the same editor for almost everything. And that was kind of an aha moment, because also in this are a lot of really great montages. And I think in addition to fantasy / dream sequences being like a really big strength for her, so too are montages. And goodness knows, I love a montage.
You know what pairs well with those montages? And this is something that we've talked about with her other movies before, too. The music in this movie is so good.
Yeah, the soundtrack's so good. Like, the second the first Beach Boys song came on, I was like, yes!
The Beach Boys, Janis Joplin's Crybaby is great, Walking on Sunshine is great.
Talking Heads are in there.
From beginning to end, it's like, this movie is just, for a movie about a baby, like a rom-com baby movie, like, it's just cool. You know, like, it's just this weird kind of cool movie.
Yeah.
Also, for the record, this is not at all the plot I thought it was. For some reason in my head, I thought the baby spoke out loud and that the parents could hear it. I didn't know what the plot was. Like, it didn't make sense in my head that they could understand him or they could hear him, but no one else could or something. But I also don't know how that would be a movie. This is just, it's different, but I like this better because this is actually a story.
This almost feels like it would work without the baby, like, talking. I mean, the baby's got to be there, but it almost feels like it would work without the baby. It wouldn't be funny.
Yeah, it could have just been a regular rom-com.
Yeah, like, it wouldn't be as funny, and I wouldn't like it as much, but it wouldn't have that niche appeal, I guess, that extra appeal to sort of set it apart. But that's the thing, like, it's just a really solid story as well, and it feels like real people problems. Like, this is fun. This kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier, Kara, where people are like, well, who wants to see movies about pregnant women? And I'm like, I do, because, like, I'm never going to get pregnant, you know what I'm saying? And, like, that's why one reason I watch a lot of movies is to witness other experiences and try and get a better understanding of ones that I'm never going to be able to have, right?
Yeah, and I mean, that's why it's so important that we need more people with diverse points of view making movies, because if you think about all of the movies that have ever been made about pregnant people, like, they've been all made by guys, and that's crazy, you know, people who've never had that experience. And I love how they managed to like sneak attack so many facts about pregnancy and childbirth into this, but
that's, I think, another level to this movie, is that it's because it presents everything as this is what real people are going through. Like, it doesn't feel glossy or like Hollywood to me in that sense, right? Like, I don't want to say like it's not a particularly good looking film, but like there aren't any really masterful swooping shots, and like, it's not really going for any of that. It's just trying to be real. And I think that really comes across, and like, I just really appreciate that about it. And like, yes, I would very much like to just, you know, see more women movies about pregnant women that aren't like Rosemary's Baby all the time or anything like that,
right? Which, oh my goodness, yeah.
Or Mike, like most of the movies in the Charlize universe where she was pregnant over and over and over again, we're like, and I think we even asked Kara, it's not, you know, not great, not directed well.
Right, that's what I was going to talk about. Well, we talked about it on the episode for the one where she walks off into the woods.
The Road.
Yeah, that I was asking you, like, how many movies she's done. In how many of them was she pregnant or has given birth or was a mother? And you guys said that you thought that it was kind of a lot.
Yes, it surprised me how often it had happened.
However, it seems often, because it's something that we don't see in movies a lot, but in real life, like, women get pregnant all the time. All the time, you know, and it's like a very much a fact of life for women. Whether we wind up wanting children or not wanting children or whatever, it's still a thing that permeates our lives and that we have to think about and we have to deal with. I mean, the fact that like we don't see menstruation in movies more is mind-boggling to me, or it would be if I didn't know everything else about why things are the way they are and why we don't see these things in movies. But like, that is so much a fact of life for women that it's the reason we don't see it more in film is because we don't have more women telling their own stories and telling stories about bodies that do things like this, you know?
Bodies do stuff.
Bodies do stuff. And a lot of times it's really weird stuff. And I love how much they kind of snuck that into this too. Like, because you see aspects of pregnancy in this, like how she's reading about postpartum depression, or how a few days after she gives birth, she realizes that suddenly her boobs are like way bigger and full of milk and whatever. And we don't get to see, you know, again, these like sexual but unsexy parts of pregnancy and childbirth.
You know, we got a lot of it in Tully, but that is a drastically different tone than this. So,
yeah, I haven't seen it, but it sounds like a very different movie.
Like, it's great, it's wonderful, but I mean, it's just nice to see it represented fairly. Like, that's all. Like, yeah, that's what I like about this movie and Tully and stuff, is that they're able to be tonally different and don't have to be just like props or something like that. We could actually get real aspects,
right,
of that life experience, which is nice.
And for so long, at least under the Hays Code, I don't even think you could show a pregnant person in a film or like use the word pregnant. Like, it would have to be with child or in a way, or like all of these like weird euphemisms for this very normal thing that happens to a lot of people in their lifetimes. And even like predating the Hays Code and just like in public life in general, pregnant women, like, historically, a lot of times have been kind of hidden away for a variety of reasons related to maternal mortality rates and all sorts of things. But I don't think I, like, appreciated it as much on the first watch of this movie than I did the second time that I watched it, because I was like, oh my god, like, it really hit me the second time, whereas the first time I was just kind of like, this is so weird. You know, and it works on like those two different levels of just being like a really weird romantic comedy or like a really salient commentary on pregnancy and childbirth and like being a woman in the world at this point in time.
I think it's just great because it's her perspective on all of this, right? And it goes even beyond that to the way that the men are portrayed in this movie as well. You know, like, I just think like that those are really sort of touchy social subjects to tap around, right? Is like not only just being a single mother, but having gotten pregnant through an affair with a married man, and all that they deal with like pretty well in this movie. I was surprised. Like, as a little kid, I didn't pick up on a lot of that stuff, but like as an adult, I was like, wow, this is like very tactful the way that they're just dealing with this, the way mm-hmm. people would deal with it, and not necessarily playing it entirely for laughs or anything, but like it's the more sort of dramatic parts of the movie, and then they could cut to the talking baby, right? And that's sort of like they have like this great out for anything in this, which is just another part of its design that is just brilliant, is like if things ever get too serious or whatever, just like cut to the talking baby, man.
I mean, if that's not a lesson to learn for filmmaking, I don't know what is.
Cut to talking baby. I want to talk about the parents in this movie, because going to what you were just saying, Mike, about how it gets into the affair versus the story that she tells about artificial insemination and everything, I got a real, and I don't want to be blasphemous to a movie that we have deemed just about perfect, Mike, but I got a real Moonstruck vibe from this family.
I wonder why.
Because that's Olympia Dukakis from Moonstruck.
Well, that might be why, but it also feels like maybe that's just her. Maybe that's just the actress coming across on screen, but it feels like it's the same kind of family. You know what I mean? Like, the same, like, this might not be true, but like way too open and just like way too nosy and just, you know, all up in her business. And also the dad who was just like happy-go-lucky, like reading the Journal of Accountancy and just like cracking up while reading, like,
oh my god,
I can only imagine is the most dry material ever.
Yeah, but what her mother says before that, because Christy Alley is was like, do you ever get bored with dad? And she's like, get bored with him? How could I ever get bored? Cut to man sitting outside laughing hysterically reading an accounting magazine. It made me laugh so hard.
I think that's her real dad, right? Is that what I read? And he actually is an accountant. And there's a line later in the movie where she's talking to, Kirstie Alley's talking to her boss, who is Amy Heckerling's husband in real life. And he says, we're not personal, we're accountants. Like, it's just this weird, not like vendetta against accountants, because it's clearly coming from a place of love, but like, how many movies are there about accountants where it's not like super important, but it's also kind of important to the story? And it's just this weird and specific, like, but coming from a place where she knows these things to be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Amy Heckerling's mother was also an accountant. So like, both of her parents. And in this movie, Kirstie Alley is like a second generation working woman, you know, which is, this is very much of the time. I talked about in the first episode that Amy Heckerling cited a article from the time about how women over 40 were however many times more likely to die by terrorist attack than find a husband. But also this is after the women's rights movement and very much a sisters are doing it for themselves sort of era. And it just, I think, captures it all like so wonderfully.
I actually got a couple of things off of the, because I don't know, from time to time I try and wonder if there's just maybe even more to it when a character has a specific job in a film. And I mean, instantly I went to, yes, it's a punchline. Like, I thought of Parks and Rec, right? When Ben goes to become an accountant and like his super dry humor is like the funniest thing ever to all of them. But also like the old stereotype of like, oh, girls aren't good at math. And it's like, well, she's an accountant. She's great at math. Like, I mm-hmm. thought that was like encouraging for people to see.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
And then lastly, I was like, well, it's kind of interesting how she's an accountant, but she hasn't been very sort of like accountable for her actions in her own life kind of thing. So like, you know, this movie kind of made me think a little more than on previous viewings, for sure.
Well, you know what I really want? I want a third generation accountant, because we get a shot of baby accountant in this movie and I loved it. I wrote down in all capital letters in my notes, baby accountant.
Oh my God, it's so cute. Yeah, that was really cute. Speaking of all caps notes, Amy Heckerling cast her best friend, Twink Kaplan, in this as her work best friend, I guess. She's the woman that she works across from. And she plays Miss Geist in Clueless. And she looks so different in this, because in Clueless, she's like wearing glasses and like looks all homely and whatever. And in this, she's got her hair done. She wears some fantastic dresses. It was really exciting for me to see her in this.
You know, this is a terrible transition, but speaking of other little things that Amy Heckerling did right, we talked about this in our thread before we started recording. We've not brought it up here. This movie has the most perfect director card, mm-hmm. where it's written and directed by Amy Heckerling atop a toilet that the name goes away and Kirstie Alley promptly vomits in before she knows that she's pregnant. Like, it's just self-deprecating or just honest or just funny. It's so good.
I just think that's the funniest thing in the world. I would totally do that, yes.
But also, I mean, there hadn't been a toilet on screen until what, like Psycho, when Hitchcock did it in Psycho? So like that...
But really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if archivists have found a movie before Psycho, but to the best of my knowledge, that's like the general trivia is like Psycho was the first to have a toilet on screen in the movie. And I think it's actually in the trailer too, which no one really picks up on. But point being is that like, yeah, to show a toilet on screen in cinema was like, you just don't. Like, talk about the Hays Code. Like, yeah. And so I think that's a nice nod to that idea.
Yeah. And also just that like so much of your life when you're pregnant revolves around a toilet, like not just like when you're vomiting or whatever, but you just have to pee like constantly. And we see that in this movie too. So I like that she got it in that way. I just think it's the funniest thing.
You know what I thought was pretty funny is when baby Mikey grows hands, he goes, "Hey, Mr. Hand."
Yeah, I wrote that down.
And this is also, I mean, this came from our friend Austin Wolf Southern's Letterboxd review. Mike, I don't know if you saw it, but he said this is one of his favorite rom-coms and also his favorite rom-com for sure that insinuates where a baby wants to blow himself. Because they're talking about, she's reading from, or she's talking to the doctor, Don S. Davis. I have to point out every time that he's on screen, Mike, in the podcast, that he plays Dana Scully's dad in X-Files.
Oh, yep, I got that down. Oh, wait, I thought he was Cigarette Smoking Man. He's Scully's dad. I didn't get super deep into X-Files, sorry. He looked familiar though, but I knew he was from the show.
Yeah, I never made it past the first season.
Guys, it's like, it might be my favorite show. Like, Leftovers and Lost are up there, but X-Files is...
No, I know it's good. People love it.
Her doctor plays Scully's dad in X-Files, but her doctor is saying that, you know, at this age, that it either sprouts the, I guess, I don't know, the penis, the vulva, and...
Yeah, that's another thing. They use anatomically correct terms in this movie, which very rarely happens. Like, because he says penis and vulva, and I was like, yes, good job.
And we cut to baby Bruce Willis, and earlier we saw him talking about the arms and, like, you know, he knows all these words somehow, and then he sees his penis sprout, and he's like, oh, look, there's another arm going down there. He's like, I wonder how I'm going to get that in my mouth. And I was like, what? Like, how is this movie? Like, man, like, it's so weird and good.
There was another scene where they were, maybe that this shot was going to be part of that scene, but it took them 115 takes to get Mikey playing with his placenta with, like, the weird little puppet. It required 12 puppeteers and involved people hanging upside down, but the shot wound up being cut from the film. Perhaps it was too graphic. I don't know.
Well, speaking of graphic, apparently Bruce Willis improv a lot of X-rated takes that I would, you know, I'm sure Amy Heckerling loved, and that those exist somewhere. I also do wonder, you know, we were talking before about how good the kids are. Like, I wonder how many hours of footage she shot that's just unusable with the kids not doing. Like, there's a stat, I don't remember what it is, Carrie, you might know this because you love nature and the outdoors. There's something like you have to be in nature for like 10 or 100 hours or something to get like 3 seconds of usable silent footage. Like, it's this ridiculous ratio because there's so much, like, you know, noise, like man-made noise in the world, that to get like even just the tiniest bit of usable, like, natural sound, you need so much. Ridiculous. Like, it's like, I don't know what the number is.
I don't know, because it depends on, like, where you are. Like, I go places in nature where I'm able to, like, record nature sounds with no problem.
There's a stat that I read one time, and I read it on the internet, so I know that it's true. But anyway.
And also, like, if you are shooting the natural world, let's say for a nature documentary or whatever, a lot of that is Foley sound or, like, sound recorded, like, when you watch Planet Earth or, like, any of the other, like, David Attenborough nature documentaries, like, that's not the noise that's happening when the camera's rolling. It's different noise.
A lot of times they're recreating the environment, too, for most of those shots as well, so it's a lot of trickery involved.
Yeah, but to your question, Joey, I don't know, but I don't actually think that there would have been a ton of extra footage. Like, that's part of the reason that they had so many babies on set, like I said before, because Amy Heckerling in interviews had said that they were really trying to do this super low budget, and because they were shooting on film and whatever, like, they couldn't just, like, burn tape, you know?
So they just had, like, a bullpen of babies that they called on for the right time.
Yeah, which is amazing.
I don't know if either of you looked this up. I looked it up while we were talking earlier. This movie, we said, had a $7 million budget. Did either of you look, or do you want to guess how much it made?
I definitely read it, but I didn't write it down, so I have no idea.
Mike, do you have any guesses? And I will say, domestic and foreign is almost an exact split. So replacing Bruce Willis with local stars seems to have paid off.
This stuff's tough.
I know, it's real tough. This is basically the Letterboxd game, but, you know, for numbers.
It was like maybe $250 million?
$300 million. $296,999.
There you go, I was close.
It was ridiculously successful. Keeping the cost low, as though Fast Times didn't give her enough leeway to do whatever she wanted, this had to have. And then I guess we'll get to it next episode for Look Who's Talking 2, T-O-O, but I wonder how much of the decision to do a sequel was hers, and what was the studio like, look, you just made essentially $300 million on nothing, like, let's do another one of these. And then there's the third one, which we might also talk about next week on Mike's podcast, that she's not involved with, but I wonder how much they wanted to keep milking it, because the other thing that I noticed was that, you know, she does Fast Times in 82, and then Giant Dangerously in 84, then European Vacation in 85, has a baby, 4 years later makes this one, and then she makes the sequel a year later, so she's obviously back to work now, but, you know, I wonder how much of it, and I'm guessing probably a lot, was the studio saying, like, we just made so much money, please make another one for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was, like, partially, like, some kind of phenomenon, right, where the studio is just like, holy shit, we just gotta milk this cow, cash in on the talking baby thing until, like, you know, it's gonna blow over soon.
Well, there was another thing, just real quick, that there, this was apparently part of the late 80s Hollywood cycle of baby pictures. There was Baby Boom, For Keeps, Immediate Family, Three Men and a Baby, She's Having a Baby, this movie, and the sequel.
Three Men and a Baby, directed by Spock himself, Leonard Nimoy. So there's, like, a Star Trek connection. on there.
A Treknection. Apparently this was very influential on the animation studio Kolaski Kosuppo, who made Rugrats, which this, I guess, in a way sort of led to Talking Baby TV show Rugrats, which is weird to think about, but also makes sense.
Oh, no, I think it makes total sense, yeah.
I could see that.
I don't know if I, like, got all my disbelief out of the way ahead of time or if it's having seen Rugrats a lot as a kid, but it, like, wasn't weird to me that the baby was talking and talking to each other. Like, for some reason that, like, didn't occur to me while I was watching it to think that that might be a weird thing.
So a couple years ago, Illumination Studios, the, I'll say it's scourge of the animation world right now, made The Secret Life of Pets, and that is, in a lot of ways, I think, similar to this. It's like, what if our pets could talk? What if our pets had inner dialogue? And that is just...
Well, that's basically every cartoon.
Sure, but that is not... I really didn't like that.
When I first saw this as a kid, like, I got a huge Garfield vibe out of it, you know? And it's, like, Stewie now, I guess, but, like, back then, I was like, well, can John hear him or not? Like, who does... Odie understands Garfield, but, like, what... Where are the boundaries? Like, and so by the time I got to Look Who's Talking, I think my mind was able to acclimate fine. And I had seen enough cartoons at that point.
You know what I kind of wish happened in this movie a little bit more, but it does, I think, toward the end, is that we have Mikey as this, like, sentient Bruce Willis, right? Where he understands the world. You know, he's limited by what his baby body can do. He can't really speak yet, but he has his mind made up halfway through the movie, really, that he wants John Travolta to be his dad, right? And I wish that there was a little bit more, although I don't want to knock this movie because I really, really like it so much that I don't want to change it, but I wish that there was more of him acting in certain ways to, like, manipulate, like, go against Albert. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there was opportunity possibly for that to do more. If that makes sense? Like, because he knows what he wants. He knows he wants to push this issue or whatever. I just wish that we saw a little bit more of that manipulation. But then when we finally go to Albert's apartment, which is very, it's all, like, bright colors and, like, clowns and a jukebox and, like, very childlike for some reason.
Yet there are choking hazards everywhere, which I loved.
Yes. And, you know, he finally, when he goes there, he sort of starts acting out and acting, you know, just to the outside world like a baby, you know, pooping and breaking things and dropping things.
But that's the first time he ever meets Albert. Like, he doesn't know that that guy is actually his dad. He has no idea who he is.
I guess we do get a little bit, like, when he is on the phone and he wants her to call. Like, he's trying, I guess, but...
It's tough. This movie has a lot to do, you know, and they kind of introduce that thread a bit late in the game. It's like the second act turning point almost is like now Mikey understands what a daddy is and he realizes he doesn't have one and he knows that James is who he wants to be his daddy and everything. And I think it's great. I think it's a great development in the movie. You know, it gives Mikey more to do. It makes him more of like a character actually. And there's some kind of nice tension going on for us, the audience, going like, is Mikey going to get what he wants? Like, because we want them to get together at this point too, but there's friction in their relationship. Because their relationship's very complex, because there's like boundary issues and those kinds of things develop when you have sort of like this, you know, 30, 40 year old guy as a male babysitter for, you know, a kid that doesn't have a dad, like as just an uncle who babysit his nephew for the last 8 years, like he slipped up and called me dad from time to time. Like it's complicated, you know, it can be tough. And so like, I just give him a lot of credit for tackling all of those issues and doing it, like, you know, very maturely and finding a way to, like, get this in the movie and not just make it sort of like a joke or something like that. Like, it actually ends up being sort of like a plot development and it carries through to the very end and to the resolution and everything. So I thought that was kind of great.
Yeah. I know that actor from things, like, with him much older, and it was weird seeing him as, like, a younger-ish guy. Because he looks so much like Lou Reed. My brain kept thinking he was Lou Reed, and I really got a kick out of imagining Lou Reed in this movie. I think it would have been hilarious.
Going back a second, Mike, you sort of triggered something in me that, you know, we're talking about how there's the reversal of Kirstie Alley as a woman good at math, but I feel like we didn't give enough credit to Amy Heckerling for writing what's sort of like a, not like a beta male, but like not like, you know, John Travolta is this like macho guy in like all of his movies, like, you know, Danny and everything. You know, he's just like this guy. He's like the man's man. Like the women want him. But here, he's broke. Like he's just like he scams places for free lunches and free long distance calls and like doesn't really make money and like is a great guy and like a great father figure to this kid and, you know, a great friend to Kirstie Alley. But in terms of what we associate, especially in movies, with like success for men, he has none of that.
And also to just have a male in a role as like kind of a primary caretaker, which we don't see a lot.
Yeah. We don't see him as a sexual being until he and Kirstie Alley kiss. Like they talk about, he talks about how he has that date that one night, but I sort of felt like that was a ruse, I think, that the date was really, in my head, I was like, you know, oh, he's just going to wait for her to come back, and like them hanging out with the kid is like the date or whatever. And it was refreshing and like unexpected to see such an unusual, at least in movies, type of male character.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the Heckerling lens. You know what I'm saying? Like that, I feel, is just, that's her point of view. That's how she sees the world. It's just like, there should be more of this type of representation for men on screen too. Like, you know, like normal guys. Like, I mean, there are things like guys that look at movies and stuff and it's like, well, I see a lot of male action heroes too, right? And like, I can't do any of that stuff. So it doesn't always make me feel great as a guy to see that all the time either, per se. But like, here's Travolta. I could totally relate to this guy. Like, you know, like I'm sort of just like, in a way, very similar to him. I don't know. Like, I could relate to him more than a lot of other male characters in movies. So that as well, like that comes from her, and I wasn't expecting that, and that's very interesting.
You know, and like as we're recording this a couple weeks ago, I think Carol is relatively caught up on this show, but like on The Good Place, the main male character who's not Ted Danson is this guy Chidi, and he's this, you know, hemming and hawing, like he's not the type of character that you would want to aspire to be. I mean, he's incredibly smart and he's kind, but he's not decisive, and that's why he's like in the predicament that he's in. And then a couple episodes ago he took a shirt off and he is like jacked, and it's like, oh, like this guy that I thought I could kind of relate to in a way, like he's now like this unattainable, like carved out of marble Greek god of a man. I'm like, where did this come from? Like, it just basically, I'm with you, Mike, more characters like this John Travolta character, please, and thank you.
He got to do his flying thing in this. Travolta, very, we're known for flying. I like to fly planes. That was cool.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, not only is he a flight instructor and pilot, but he also does airplane with Mikey, where he like lays on his back and holds him up so Mikey can be a plane. I thought that was adorable.
And there's also, while we're talking about Travolta, the third movie apparently he's in, that's Staying Alive. Please. So, I mean, yeah. He's not in the scene with Staying Alive, but, you know.
It's his signature song, I guess, until Pulp Fiction comes around. And
sure. It's his Wicked Game with Cage, I guess. So I guess the closest time that we get to him as a sexual being is when he goes to his airport hangar and there's that like really ditzy blonde who asks him, oh, is the baby yours? And he says, yeah, we're just trying to find out who the real mother is, which is like such a reversal of things to say. And she's like, oh my God, like fully buys into it. And he's like, no, I'm kidding. Then he sees Mikey looking at her boobs, and Mikey, we hear his inner dialogue, and this is a great line. These things come in different sizes. What are the jumbos? And he sees Mikey looking and says, look at you staring at them. We must be thinking the same thing. And Mikey just goes, lunch. It's just like, oh man, like just, you know, he is like a dude like looking at boobs, but for a completely different purpose, which is wonderful.
Oh God, yeah. There's another time that when he's alone with Mikey, right after he's born, and he's like, how do you like in the outside world? It's pretty crazy, huh? You spend 9 months trying to get out and the rest of your life trying to crawl back in.
Boy, oh boy. I mean, there, I guess also another thing sexual, like these are sort of sexual-ish innuendos, but there's also the scene where Travolta's taking the splinter out of her finger and it sounds from the hallway like they're having sex.
Not particularly comfortable or good sex, though.
No, like it's sticking in me, get it out. But then when he walks out, just the way that he like casually zips up his fly, it's just, I don't know why it was down, I don't know why he chose to do it there, but it's just like the cherry on top of this wonderful scene. And you know, her mom just responds perfectly and just like, who was that? Like, what is going on here?
Yeah. So we touched on this a bit before about that like almost sex scene, but I think this has been to date the best example of a female gaze in a sex scene that we've seen, because the way that she frames Kirstie Alley, like she is on top, she's just taking her shirt off, and the way that she's framed, you don't actually see her boobs, you just see like the triangle part top of her bra, which I was like, well, I like that bra. I want to see more of it, but I appreciate this. And just the entire way that she shoots that scene, the only time that you see Kirstie Alley is either like the top half of her body or her full body are like in positions where she's not being sexy. And it's only after like the sexy part has stopped and she's like, no, you have to leave. And like, we can't do this, that the camera is like further back and you see more of her, which I found really interesting.
Because what I noticed in that scene is that, you know, when Travolta starts like kissing her and I guess maybe going down on her, I don't know, but like her face and her entire body is sort of like buried in the comforter, and like it's shot from that low angle, like where we can't see anything. And I'm just like, oh, this is a very like a wildly different perspective. Like I didn't think about it in terms of the whole scene, but I definitely noticed that shot as like this is something different. This is a different point of view, different perspective than what we normally see in movies.
Yeah, I think it services the character well too, right? Because at that point she has not had sex in a long time, and she has been vocal about that too. And then when it happens with the person she probably least expected, it turns in, and I think why maybe she stops it too to a degree is because it becomes way more personal than she might have thought it would at first. And I think it's shot that way too, right? When we're just focused on her and it's like what she's going through and just trying to read it off her face and everything. And so I definitely thought that was called for and appropriate and everything. And so I was glad that, yeah, I didn't really expect them to go softcore or anything in this movie to any degree, but like there is that one moment where she catches the guy in the dressing room, right? And like they're really going at it. There's parts in this movie where she's like, she thinks she's alone and she's doing the burlesque dance for Mikey, and Travolta comes in and they start dancing.
Which is weird.
It's weird, but, and I was thinking, unfortunately, it reminded me of European Vacation. There's a burlesque moment in that too. Everything is sort of sequenced appropriately, which is nice. Like when they get to the sex scene, it's not about gratuity. It's about emotion and thought and her thoughts and what she's thinking and feeling and stuff. And so that's how it was presented, and that's good. That shows, I mean, to me that shows a lot of discipline too,
and also probably a lot of arguments with the studio. I mean, I don't know for sure, I didn't read anything about this, but you know, if you're shooting a sex scene, like give the people what they want, you know. Like at least frame her differently or something, make it a little bit sexier. And I'm curious like how much back and forth she had to do to get her movies made the way that she wanted to make them, even, you know, working with a cinematographer or other producers or like whatever, like the kind of arguments, because when women say things, people don't listen. This is a fairly common thing that people know, I think, right?
Wait, Kara, what were you saying?
That when people, when women say something,
oh, okay, cool.
Listen. Especially when they're telling somebody else to do something. And we even see a glimpse of that in this movie, just as she gets to the hospital when she's in labor, and there's this like back and forth about her insurance card and that she doesn't have it with her. And the doctor wants to walk away from the nurse's station to go with Kirstie Alley as she's admitted. And the nurse is like, you didn't finish filling out this form. You have to fill out this form. I cannot do my job if you do not finish filling out this form. I have been that woman so many times, not necessarily in that hospital situation, but like in various jobs where I'm like, I can't do my job if you don't do yours, you know? And so I just was kind of thinking about that at certain points in this movie where I was like, I can't believe she managed to pull this off.
Yeah, it almost reminded me of the old argument, you know, it's sexual, but it's not sexy, right? What we were saying, right? And she's like, yeah, that's the point, dude. So yeah, that's fine. She's still fighting that battle, but at least it's great that she won this one.
Yeah. So I was thinking after we recorded, whatever the last thing was that my brain keeps erasing.
European Vacation. Do not think about it as any more than you have to.
That. Yeah. Well, so phallic imagery has come up in every movie so far, basically. There was the large salami log in Fast Times at Ridgemont High that they're slicing up. There was the dancing dick.
The cartoon dicks. Yep.
Yeah, in Johnny Dangerously. There was something in the last one that I don't remember. Oh, the bratwurst. Because there's a point, I don't remember. Maybe it wasn't in Germany. There's a sausage at some point.
When they thought they're visiting Clark's relatives, but it's actually the wrong people, and they're all going around the table sort of with the bratwurst.
Yeah, and the daughter like sees the sausage and she's like, oh, I miss whatever her boyfriend's name was. And then in this movie, I was like, I had an eye out for phallic imagery because I was like, is this something that's going to keep coming up? Because I know it comes up in Clueless. And the breadstick.
Oh, yes.
Which it wouldn't have occurred to me except that in Clueless, it is also a breadstick.
Well, because the way that Travolta describes starting a car is you put the stick in the hole, which is not the way that anybody would describe that, I don't think, at all.
No. He's a flight instructor, not a driving instructor.
I guess. But he still knows how to drive a car. Like, it's not like he's an idiot. But then Mikey takes the breadstick and then tries to stick it in the hole, and then it works. Like, you know, I guess that's his first sexual experience? I don't know. It's just this weird...
No, I think don't read too much into the phallic imagery. I think she's just putting it in there kind of as a joke. And there may or may not, I would have to like go back and do another pass through all of these movies. There might also be a lot of like vulva imagery in her movies, because there's been, at least in Johnny Dangerously's apartment, there were some Georgia O'Keeffe-esque paintings on the wall. And there was one in this movie too, I think. So maybe she's just into sex organs. I don't know. Or she just thinks putting them in movies is funny, which I also
that
think
might be,
is funny.
Yeah, I think that's hilarious. It's like subliminal imagery.
Yeah. And also is kind of subliminal fuck you on the sexual but not sexy, like, criticism. Speaking of John Travolta in the car, when he is driving Kirstie Alley to the hospital, he's like speeding through the streets and he yells at some guy, hey, why don't you pull over till the lewds wear off? Which, as we know, is part of Amy Heckerling's personal philosophy that people on Quaaludes should not drive.
Luckily, the world's almost out of lewds. So, Kara, I definitely thought of you during a moment in this movie when we visit Abe Vigoda and he's got huge, bushy eyebrows and Mikey grabs at him.
His eyebrows! Yeah, I wrote that down. Yeah, his eyebrows are great. Abe Vigoda was a very nice man. He used to come into the store that I worked in all the time. But he was very particular. He would, like, only let certain people help him.
Were you one of those people?
I only want Kara to help me today. Only Kara.
No. No, it was one of my friends. And then if he was busy, he would let me help him. But, you know. But also, I think that this was like another kind of added layer of complexity to the film, Abe Vigoda's character and his storyline with John Travolta, who's... So Abe Vigoda's character is some form of dementia, and John Travolta is trying to get him into the right home with caretakers around the clock. And that's like another thing that we don't get to see in movies. I mean, as far as movies and like American popular culture, old people don't exist, you know what I mean? And certainly not when it comes to more complex storylines about trying to get them care when they are aging and like in a vulnerable position.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays you get four old dudes trying to rob a bank in Brooklyn, you know, a comedy heist. I saw that movie. I took my dad. It was like 2 years ago, you know, Morgan Freeman. I mean, they're all in that one. But yeah, absolutely.
Or four old women reading 50 Shades of Grey for the first time.
Oh my God, I cannot wait to see that. I haven't yet. I don't, not 50 Shades of Grey. I don't care about that.
Wait, is that book club? That's called book club,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mike, you're going to have to cover it for your podcast. You're going to have to find a way to talk about it because it's the embodiment of your final segment.
Well, like reading the novelization of a movie called Book Club would like probably make your head blow up.
Extremely meta. But I mean, that movie is full of American treasure, elder women that we don't get to see like interact with each other. Like that one of them might be in something, but they're all in one thing.
Including one
exciting.
Of my favorites, Mary Steenburgen, who is just...
Oh, what a treasure.
But Mike, you have to cover that movie when you cover 50 Shades Freed or whatever the third one is. Because I think whatever the third one is.
I got to have a month where I do that and Twilight in the same month.
Oh, no. Just get it over with?
It spawned from Twilight, didn't it? Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think it was Twilight fanfic. Yes. That's how it started.
Right. That just got way out of control.
Way out of control.
I have a couple notes real quick, just like little observations. I always love when babies speak like old men, and Bruce Willis calls the terrible blind date that you went on, the accountant. He says, who's this yutz? And just like this like little baby like talking Yiddish, like I just made me smile.
Didn't Olympia Dukakis doing her like baby talk? I think she was throwing around some Yiddish like before the when we're going to have a bubba or something. I thought maybe it was like in inherited or something from her.
Maybe. I like when he, when Mikey is with the girls in the sandbox and he learns about what a daddy is, and he says, he tells the joke, how many babies does it take to screw in a light bulb? And he says, the punchline is, what's a light bulb? And then one of the girls is like, I don't get it, which... just like a funny all-around little thing. And then one other thing that I noticed with this was just a weird thing is when Travolta is sort of spying on her, he comes over and she's doing that burlesque dance for Mikey, and he looks in, he's sort of like watching her. In the cabinet, there's Pringles, and I was like, I didn't know Pringles were around in 1989, but it also looks like it's Pringles, like apostrophe S. Like, was there a Mr. or Mrs. Pringle, and this is their chips? So many things. Like, clearly the tall cylinder, cylindrical canister seems delivery method, but just like, you know, obviously 80s art and then maybe a different style, but like, I did not realize that Pringles were that old. I thought they were more of like a 90s thing or something.
No, we had Pringles. I remember getting them at Grand Union.
Ooh.
We had Grand Union back in the day.
Yeah, one of those too.
One shot I loved is because there's a lot of sort of product placement going on, and no one was ever more gratuitous with it than Cheerios. I mean, they got their box in everything during the 80s and such, and there's just a great shot in here where the Cheerios box is kind of like half off the shelf, and they just didn't do an extra take to get it right because they clearly just don't give a shit because it's just a fucking product placement thing. And so that's how I read it. That's what came to mind to me, and I just thought that was funny. I was like, yeah, no respect for that product placement.
There is a shot like right after the very brief touch on postpartum depression, her mother comes over and is like, you need to spend some time by yourself, like go out, do some things, whatever, I'll take care of the baby. Cut to the camera kind of looking up at the skyline, and there's a Hitachi billboard in the shot. And I don't know if it just happened to be there or if they put that there on purpose, but Hitachi is or was the manufacturer of the iconic vibrator, the Hitachi Magic Wand, which I like went back and like looked up the history of, and it was invented in 1968 and then became very popular in the 70s during the women's movement and was like this kind of like feminist icon. And I just feel like that cannot possibly be an accident that her mother's like, go spend some time with yourself, cut to Hitachi billboard, you know.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Now I'm, for some reason, I know exactly what reason, going to link Brian Rodriguez in the High School Slumber Party podcast to that vibrator because you used iconic vibrator.
Yeah.
So Brian, this one's for you. We mentioned at the really early on that at the end there is another sperm and ova sequence that leads to another baby, and that baby is voiced by Joan Rivers in her like one line of dialogue. But I looked up, and unfortunately, I mean, I would love to see a movie with Joan Rivers as the baby. The little sister in the second movie is voiced by Roseanne. So,
which I remembered when I got offline last time we recorded, because I was like, yeah, I'm really excited for the next two Look Who's Talking movies, and I was like, oh wait, Roseanne does the voice in the next one. I was really disappointed because Joan Rivers' signature line is, can we talk? And so it's just like a perfect button, like that's her catchphrase. So it was just like the perfect button, the perfect joke to go out on in this movie. And really, like, if they were going to do a sequel, how can you get anyone else now? You've set it up so perfectly. So a little foreshadowing. I was a little bummed that Joan Rivers did not return.
Yeah. We'll see what the next movie is. Mike, have you seen the next one?
I've seen Look Who's Talking 2. Not in theaters, but I can't recall ever seeing the third one. So,
well, we will find out soon enough.
Indeed.
So for the voice of Mikey, while talking about voices, Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Steve Martin, and John Candy were considered, but they were all busy with other projects. Robin Williams was considered, but apparently he wanted like $14 million or something, and the budget was $7 million. They obviously could not afford his crazy, crazy financial demands.
They actually cut the budget in half by moving the production from New York to Vancouver.
The other thing was that this is the only movie... Well, John Travolta said that this is the character that is most like his personality, which I guess is a good thing. If he's actually like this character, that's a really good thing. But he also said this is the only movie he's ever seen of his, or the first one or something, where he watched the premiere and was like, oh, this is going to be a hit. Again, I don't know when that quote was from. Maybe it was way after the fact that throw was a hit. But, you know, I feel like this is the kind of movie where you're like, oh, I can see why literally everyone would want to and would enjoy this movie.
It was crazy. It really struck me this time watching it, knowing what ends up happening in film history with Travolta and Tarantino and his whole resurgence and everything. And it's like, if that never happened, he would have gone on to been like a great character actor for the rest of his career. Just like one of those guys, kind of like Richard Jenkins, who pops up everywhere and is really good and solid and everything. But like, no, like he got propelled into superstardom once again only a few years later.
And he's just so good in this movie. He's so good in this movie. I think that's all the notes and stuff that I have to say about this. I hope the next one is even remotely as enjoyable as this one. We will see. I'm not going to doubt Amy Heckerling again now that she's in control of these movies. I'm going to have full faith in her, but just, you know, sequels generally, especially when they're to a movie that's this good, tall act to follow, I'm just hoping, yeah, you know, it's enjoyable. I know that Bruce Willis is back. I didn't look. Are Travolta and Kirstie Alley back?
Yes.
We will see next week for Look Who's Talking 2, and then also on Mike's podcast, Look Who's Talking Now. Lots of baby talk in a week from now.
Yeah. One thing before we wrap up, there is a lot of stuff about weight in this movie. Some of it good, some of it bad. Like, Albert's wife is bulimic, and it's like one of the first jokes in the movie, which is very tasteless.
But I think it's tasteless for a point,
on
yes,
purpose.
To show that he's
yeah.
despicable. Like, every time, what's the line? Like, every time I even mention divorce, she loses 5 pounds. Like, he sees it as a good thing because he's a monster and just wants her to be thin.
Yeah. I just hope they wouldn't make that joke if this was made today.
Well, there's also, I mean, at the very end, Bruce Willis, as the baby, says, like, what am I, a retard or something like that? And I'm just like, oh, that's very clearly we're in 1989 right now. So there's, I think, a couple things that would hopefully be changed if we remade it today.
Yeah.
Do you think they'd remake this?
Actually, in 2010, it was reported that none other than Fast and Furious producer Neil H. Moritz had plans to bring the Look Who's Talking franchise
back. Oh, with the baby by Vin Diesel?
Heckling hopes the reboot does happen.
Oh, baby Vin Diesel.
Yes, please.
Saying that I'd make some money. So here's hoping. I hope Amy gets paid. But the other thing about weight in this movie is that she uses it as a marker of the passing of time during the pregnancy montage, which the first time that I watched it, I was like, oh, brother, why do we have to keep hammering home this whole weight gain thing? And then the second time that I watched it, I actually was thinking a lot more about kind of how women's bodies and women's weight is policed in general, but like especially when they're pregnant. And it reminded me that a two very good friends of mine just had a baby, and like literally the day after my friend gave birth, a doctor who was just covering somebody else's shift, wasn't even her doctor, walked into her hospital room, saw a box of Dunkin' Donuts munchkins on the table, and said, actually, you know what, I'm gonna reference the text message because I just want to get this right. It's pretty ridiculous.
While you think about that, this reminds me of also once again Mike of Tully, where Charlize, you know, pregnant, goes through what feels like a normal pregnancy, and then her brother Mark Duplass, his wife, is talking about how she was doing yoga until the hour she gave birth, like all this, like, you know, what a pregnancy should be, where, you know, where Albert's wife only gained 21 pounds while she was pregnant because she was running 3 miles a day. Like, just like this
yes,
stereotypical
yeah,
what a pregnant woman should do as opposed to what a pregnant woman actually realistically would be like, which is, you know, Kirstie Alley in this, or I'm assuming, I don't know, or Charlize Theron in Tully.
Well, and even when we were recording The Road, I was like, that childbirth scene didn't feel
right.
Like, she's giving birth in the apocalypse, like, why isn't she more worried about this, you know? And I loved that in this movie, when Kirstie Alley is trying to ask for, pain medication while she's in
yes.
labor, the nurse tells her to, like, do her breathing better, and then in, like, an exorcist voice yells, fuck my breathing! And it's PG-13, they saved the only fuck for the perfect moment.
Which is wonderful. We were just talking about that in the Fast 5 episode, which we recorded recently, which came out about a month ago, on Too Fast, Too Forever, about, you know, that one PG-13 fuck and just how it can be used so well. And, you know, when The Rock gets it especially, it's great. But in this one, also great. Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention about the weight before we get to the text message is that when she's getting on the scale, like, this movie effortlessly spans time in a really impressive way, I think, like, through that montage and through, like, just him getting older, the baby getting older and stuff like that. But she gets on the scale and weighs herself and shrugs the first time, and then like sort of forces herself to shrug like the third time, I think. But I was thinking, you know, 20 years or 15 years later, she would be in that show, which I've never seen, Fat Actress. And I was like, oh, this is like a...
Oh, it's so good. It's like almost as good as The Comeback.
I have not seen that yet, but I will see that
Lisa Kudrow show. Oh my God.
She was good on Cheers too. She was, yeah.
Where Everybody Knows Your Name.
And Veronica's Closet was also really good.
Kara, did you find that text?
Yes. She said, some doctor, not mine, he was covering, came in to check me out yesterday morning, said I seemed good, all was well, then looked at the munchkins on the table my parents had brought and went, no more Dunkin' Donuts, huh? And we were obviously like several question marks. And he said, gotta lose the weight postpartum, right? Huh. And this is an older gentleman doctor, literally had never spoken to them before, walked into the hospital room. And this was how he decided to introduce himself, by making a comment about the weight of a woman who gave birth yesterday.
Well, as we know, dudes generally not good at things in general, and also dudes and, you know, jokes. I mean, like, we know this specifically from today. Dudes and jokes, people don't think about things before they say them. I'm not giving this guy any benefit of the doubt, but just, like, it doesn't surprise me because guys are dumb.
Yeah, I have had doctors say things you would not believe to me, so it, like, does not surprise me either, but at the same time, I was just like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. Also, this was, like, right after the Kavanaugh hearings, too, so I was, like, extra mad, but...
Does her baby speak? Your friend's baby.
Not yet, but she has another one who's just figured it out. So, one last thing about this movie. And physical violence is never okay, but I love how many times Kirstie Alley beats the shit out of John Travolta in this movie. It's great, because they get out of the car when they get to the hospital, and she just starts beating him up because he was driving so crazy, which I loved. And then later on, when he's babysitting, he tells her to go take a nap. And then, without leaving a note or any sort of indication that he took the baby somewhere, he takes the baby somewhere and puts him in the front seat.
Oh, also, leaves without a diaper bag or food. Like, just, like, I thought, like, that was so amateur babysitter, just dude, like, you know, I don't know if I would have thought about it in the time of that when he was coming back and he just, like, just comes back with the baby. I was like, oh, right, you brought nothing with you. If literally anything went wrong, you were up Schitt's Creek without a paddle. But it's a good thing that this baby is the coolest baby in the history of babies, because he's able to sort of be self-sustainable for the entire time.
Yeah, but she straight up punches him in the face, which I love, because that's the appropriate reaction to that, which is, like, someone that you barely know took your baby without telling you. And then she starts hitting him with the diaper bag. I loved it. It's great.
Karen, any other thoughts about Look Who's Talking before we come back next week for the sequel to this movie? We don't do a lot of sequels on the network, so especially, you know, within the same series. So
yeah, so far, car crashes in every movie.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, that cab ride scene was really well orchestrated. Like, that was good action directing there. I was kind of caught off guard, and it kind of felt, I know Joe, you don't really care for this movie, but one of the best moments in Die Hard 3 is the cab ride through Central Park. And I was like, wow, this is sort of like reminding me of that, just like crazy cab rides in New York City. Really cool.
I do want to rewatch Die Hard 3, but you are right, I do not like that movie very much. I just don't think it's a Die Hard movie. It's because it wasn't originally a Die Hard. This is a different thing, but it wasn't originally a Die Hard movie. It was shoehorned to fit it into a Die Hard movie, and people like it. I don't, but you know,
fair enough.
Neither here nor there. Mike, any other thoughts about Look Who's Talking?
Well, just that I hadn't really watched this movie all the way through in, I mean, at least 10 years or so, but I had watched it so much growing up since I was 10. So, like, as a teenager, I mean, we used to bring a bunch of movies down the shore with us every year, and this was always there. So it was just always around, and I'm just really glad that it holds up. I think it might play, parts of it play better than it did, because I'm just older and I can understand the movie on a very different level now.
Yeah, if I saw this 5 years ago, I don't think I would have appreciated it the way that I did seeing it as a 31-year-old woman. So I'm glad that I came to it at this time in my life.
Yeah, and I just think it's a great representation of Amy Heckerling too. Like, I feel like I said earlier, like, I feel like I know her as a person better, and that's what great filmmakers can do, is be self-expressive and personal and be able to relate all that without getting confusing or too complex or anything. It's just like she has a very straightforward way of explaining all of this, and it just came across so well, and it was just such a breeze and just so nice to watch, and it was just a lot of fun, and I'm really glad that we all liked it.
Yeah, I am in the process of upgrading my Letterboxd rating of it from 3.5 stars after the first watching to 4.5 stars.
Whoa.
I really loved this. And just quickly about getting a better sense of Amy Heggerling, or getting a consistent sense from movie to movie, just very briefly, that set decoration and the costumes in this were also really great, which is something that's come up a bunch of times and will continue to come up.
Yeah, Kirstie Alley looked great in like everything she wore in this movie. Good on you, Amy Heggerling, and also the set and costume decorator.
Yeah. And also the lighting design was great. Yeah, it was a great movie.
It's also a weird movie, but a great movie. So anyway, come back next week for Look Who's Talking To, and also on Mike's podcast, Look Who's Talking Now, two baby movies, one day, next week, next Monday the 17th. But for all things Cinemakers, including the three other movies we've done in here, and the other 44 or something that we've done up to this point, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email this show, cinemakers@cageclub.me. Here's a little thing that I've been saying. You know, I've been saying we'll get to your emails at some point. The last thing we're recording for this series is the Red Oaks episodes that she directed, so we're going to probably have a pretty wide gap between the time we record the 9th episode and that one, so we can watch the series. So there's a chance, if you're listening to this, you want to write in, we'll be able to read it on that episode. If you don't want to write in, that's totally fine. Email cinemakers@cageclub.me. We will see it. We will respond to it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for writing. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I am Cara Gallo-Regan.
We'll see you next time for more baby movies right here on Cinemakers.